Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week, how art will play a big role in the celebration of Lexington's 250th anniversary. That's coming up in part two of Art Checkett's conversation with Lexington Arts and Culture Director Heather Lyons. First, I've recently had several conversations about life in rural communities around the state, beginning with Loka Ashwood, sociologist at the University of Kentucky, who is clearly making an impact. She's the author of For Profit Democracy, Why the Government is Losing the Trust of Rural America, which is an investigation of how the construction of a nuclear power plant in Burke County, Georgia, has driven distrust in government. Loka recently received one of academia's most prestigious awards, a MacArthur Genius Grant, for her research on rural identity, environmental injustice, and corporate power. And she's joining us here on Eastern Standard to talk about all of that. Welcome, Loka.
Thank you so much for having me.
And first, I just have to ask, what is it like to get a call, I guess, or a letter letting you know that you'd won a MacArthur Genius Grant?
It's the biggest happy shock of my life. For sure.
Was it a call? Or was it?
It was a series of missed calls when I was on my way to campus. I usually bike onto campus. I don't live too far away, and I got into my office and saw it. Missed a series of calls from a Chicago number, and I had meetings and just went straight into those meetings, and then came out and was staring at my phone, thinking, "Who could this possibly be?" When my cell phone rang again, and I answered that time because I figured whoever it was really needed to get a hold of me, and they probably or hopefully had a valid reason. So I'm glad I did answer.
Well, how do you plan to use the grant, if I may ask?
I'm still figuring it out, but I guess my ideal scenario is that I'll take a portion of the funds and have a revolving pot of money that's available to communities in need, in the moments of need that they may have. You never know what's going to come up, but a lot of times when I go into rural communities that are coping with an environmental injustice, they need something immediately, like some water quality tests that can be quite expensive. So to be able to use some of the funds for that purpose would be ideal, but I'm still talking with folks, and I need to move faster. But just to figure out how to organize that institutionally to get that money where it needs to be so the money can be given back out to communities with ease, I haven't figured out yet, but I think I'm hopefully getting closer.
Well, that's a wonderful intent. And I know that you study how environmental issues, corporations, and state policy converge in ways that have hurt rural communities and, importantly, have reduced their trust in democracy. And there's so much in that sentence to ask you about, but I'd like to begin with a dynamic that's kind of weighing heavily in current American politics, trust in democracy. What have you learned about how environmental issues and corporate behavior and state policy have worked to erode faith in democracy?
This may sound odd, but I think the most important thing is that there's some good news in this regard, and that's that people believe that democracy can and should be doing more. So in the communities that I've worked with, and in Burke County, which is where for-profit democracy plays out, folks expect the government to protect their property rights in ways that are constitutionally defined. They expect to have access to clean water and due process. So they have this higher faith and this expectation that's not being met. And I say that's good news because although there's this distrust that's forming, it means that they believe that there can be something better and there should be something better. And that's something that I hold on to and I think is a way to also galvanize action, is to really stay focused on that people want more and they believe that there can be a better democracy that's serving them.
So it's not a loss in the concept of democracy. It's a loss of faith in how it's being carried out, correct?
Exactly. Yep.
Well, you are dedicated to amplifying the voices of rural communities, something that we share with you here at Eastern Standard and WEKU. But what drives that dedication?
It's multifaceted. I guess as I grew up in a rural place, and of course that shapes how you know and see the world.
And where was that?
That was in rural Illinois, is where I'm from. So I always have that sense of accountability. But I think what's driven me more over the years is this sort of default assumption that if there's fewer people living in a space, that this utilitarian notion that's active in our regulatory policies and pretty imbued in the way our democracy works right now, that they should have to take on more burden, more risks, especially with things like nuclear power, which the Federal Code of Regulations says you can only site a nuclear power plant in a sparsely populated place. So it's this sort of embedded assumption that rural people have to take it and should take it, and the ways in which it's sometimes manipulated to keep on taking, and that taking doesn't stop. That's what really motivates me, is to recognize that it doesn't have to be that way and find other alternatives.
I wonder, what are the most important complexities that we need to know about in order to understand these challenges that are faced by our rural communities?
Yes. Any development project or any project that has environmental implications is indeed complicated. But what I've found is that the worst environmental injustices unfold when communities have been stripped of their capacity to self-actualize or have usufruct, where they have not only the capacity to benefit from a development project, but to also use it. So what I have found in rural contexts is when environmental injustices are the worst is when something is being placed in a rural community to take from it, but not for people there also to have access to that good. So, for example, with the Vogtle nuclear reactors in Burke County, Georgia, the folks locally aren't accessing that power. We have the same sort of dynamic that can play out in agriculture, especially if there's absentee ownership, where rural communities are producing the good, but they're not necessarily getting the returns from that productive process. And that relates a lot to absentee ownership, but it's the same in energy production. So what I really look at is how can we have profits circulating back locally, especially if there's expectations that people sacrifice something that means a lot to them. And in a lot of rural spaces, you know, those are basic things like access to the land, access to clean air, and access to clean water.
Well, in your work, you investigate how rural communities confront environmental degradation, economic hardship, social alienation. And that trio of pretty powerful influences that in many ways go hand in hand and intersect. What are some ways that communities are pushing back against these kinds of forces?
Well, one of my favorite chapters in For-Profit Democracy, and I haven't written about this really anywhere else, it's called The Rural Rebel. And in some cases, people engage in direct action to take back what has been taken. So that's acts of poaching or trespassing on land that's been claimed through eminent domain, either by the state of Georgia or from a for-profit company, in this case, a subsidiary of Southern Company, which is Georgia Power, practicing eminent domain to take land. So that's one way that you do see people pushing back. It's outside of the law and it's through direct action. The other ways that I see people pushing back is through collective organizing at the local level and engaging in acts of reciprocity and mutual aid and support that are direct to help each other in these time of needs. And then there's these amazing community organizers that can find areas in the law that they can gain power through. And that's how they push back. They're very clever. They may have backgrounds in the law or they may have been legal aides at some time. But they're able to find elements of the law that work for them to help their communities. So I see different routes of action taking place. And, you know, another one that's very common in rural areas is, and this is happening in Burke County, Georgia, is relying on faith. So a lot of action happening through rural churches. And there's a deep history of the environmental justice movement being connected to Black Baptist churches in the Deep South. And that's a very important center for organizing in Burke County, Georgia.
You know, I'm really curious about a quote of yours that I came across where you said that your approach to working with communities is understanding their grievances and turning that into a question. Tell us about that. How does that work?
Well, for underserved rural communities, there's so many cases that I can think of. But for example, in northern Alabama, there was a community I was working with that was very concerned about childhood cancer, acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and acute myeloid leukemia in particular, and they were trying to get help. It's just the small little town of Fruithurst, Alabama, less than 300 people. You know, the whole school district's only about 750 households, the elementary school there. And so I helped them by using this process that uses public meetings, coming up with voted and strategy lists to take on the question of how can you reduce leukemia in Fruithurst and the surrounding area. And I did that with close and deep collaborations with people who live there, in this case, Dr. Christy Hyatt, the elementary school principal, but concerned parents, concerned families, people just with children at large in that area that wanted help. And so it moved from a status of quiescence when people were just stalled and not able to take any action to turning it into this question of enabling people to have a process to voice their concerns and their ideas about what could be contributing to leukemia in our community. And, you know, in this case, they came up with a list of strategies that people signed up for and then worked in groups to just keep going and keep going to take action locally. And I find that to be really empowering for communities, and it makes a long-lasting change that's also locally embedded. And it happens also because they have such close relationships to begin with. And in some cases, it makes those relationships even closer, builds new ones.
So this was a cancer cluster, and which raises the suspicion that something's causing this. Has that connection been made?
Yes. Yeah, so part of the strategies that were come up with by the community was let's test the water. You know, that's what happens a lot. Let's test the water, but also let's do interviews with affected families. And then that ballooned out into a survey of the entire elementary school district, that 750 or so households. So, you know, each one of those methods uncovered similar but different things. So we found semi-volatile organic compounds in some of the wells that we sampled where families with leukemia, either mothers while they were pregnant had drank well water, or children were drinking from that well water themselves. And, you know, this is a larger structural issue for rural communities, is that their groundwater is not monitored. Their well water isn't monitored. And there isn't a pot of money supporting the level of testing that we did for like semi-volatile or volatile organic compounds. So we found bis to ethylhexylphthalate in some of those wells. We found lead at levels of which would not be acceptable if you were drinking city water from a municipality that had maximum contaminant levels. Now, when we did interviews, we also found that, you know, well water was consumed by affected families. But when we branched out and did a broader survey, we still found that across all cancer types that there was association with drinking well water. But we found an even more powerful association to actually pesticide exposure. People who said that there was boom or aerial spraying of pesticides proximate to where they lived. And that is something that came out of a different method, the survey method. And the folks in Fruithurst, you know, through the grants that we got, they were able to put in reverse osmosis systems, or in some cases, cap the wells and get connected to municipal water supplies. Although not unilaterally, because there's not enough money for that. Unfortunately, that's part of where this rural animosity comes from. But what they have not had luck with in Alabama and in Cleburne County and Fruithurst is getting the municipal government to stop spraying the roadsides instead of coming out and mowing them. And also the utility power lines, in this case, Alabama Power, is spraying instead of mowing. And there's concerned families across Alabama that are not getting action taken in that regard. So I think the empowerment and the knowledge is there now with the community. They know that there's some forms of action that have happened, but not enough. Not enough action, but there is some that has happened.
On the local government side, is it simply ignoring these concerns, or are these local governments themselves strapped and unable? Yeah.
That's what they say. Yeah. Although, you know, it's a board of commissioners there. It'd be the Cleburne County Commissioners. And, you know, folks involved in our research have been elected to positions, but in minority positions where they're saying it's worth the cost to pay someone to mow. I mean, is this, you know, that we're coming down to having this argument that it's too expensive to mow the roadsides in certain part of this country rather than spray them. I think that's a wild thing to be considering when if, for example, if I would talk about this case in the Northeast, people would be like, oh, well, we're working on restoring prairies and not mowing in our roadsides. So the different benefits that accrue regionally and the different costs and across this country is very discouraging, right? But I think that empowerment can help for rural people.
Well, I may be asking you to speculate here, and if you're not comfortable with that, it's fine. But I'm just wondering if you see any parallels between these experiences that you've studied in Alabama and Georgia and life in the eastern Kentucky coal fields.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I do. But in emerging areas of work, I've been lucky to work with Lycan here, mm-hmm. as well as the Appalachian Citizens Law Center, where we're really concerned with corporate ownership structures in eastern Kentucky, particularly Bell and Martin County. Who owns the land of mines that aren't being properly maintained? Or how can we actually get down to the ultimate beneficiaries of this structure in eastern Kentucky? So it's a similar animosity that I see across my research. You know, in Alabama, it's absentee timberland owners that have these incredibly complicated corporate hierarchies that are enabling them to take so much with fewer repercussions. And we see this in eastern Kentucky, too, which with so much absentee-owned land. We're really interested in getting at the way in which we're organizing corporate power so we can try to make it more about community power. How can we change corporate law so it's not so extractive and more is going back to the community? So I see the same thing in any resource-dependent community. And this the corporate structure that's so problematic in this country is, you know, it's in agriculture, it's in energy, it's in timber. And so I think the methods that we're using can also help folks in eastern Kentucky.
Well, before we go, Loka, I'm curious, what are you working on right now?
That's one of the projects is specific to eastern Kentucky energy ownership structures, because if we're going to have a just transition that gives back jobs and economic development to rural communities in Kentucky, I mean, we need to make sure that we have an ownership structure that's not still sucking the resources out. And that can come with agrivoltaics. It can come with solar. If that money doesn't circulate back locally, we're going to be replicating the same issues that we've had in the past. Although we can disagree over the technologies, the ownership still really matters. I'm also working on a project with colleagues on a social network analysis of global agribusinesses. So in agriculture across 9 sectors, like ranging from poultry to tractor inputs, you know, who's gained market power where and how is this pushing smaller and medium-sized farmers out of business? And so our hope is that when we better understand these problematic structures and who and what is financing them, we can come up with alternatives, because this is the law that's created this situation. It's not natural. It's a created nature. And I think that we can do other things that are better for everyone, but also our rural communities.
All right. That's University of Kentucky's sociologist Loka Ashwood, a recipient of a 2024 MacArthur Genius Grant for her research on rural identity, environmental injustice, and corporate power. Thank you so much, Loka.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Tyler McDaniel is the Environmental Justice Program Coordinator with the Community and Economic Development Initiative of Kentucky, or CEDIC. He provides technical assistance and best practices for communities to identify, work with, and transform the ways they're impacting the environment. Tyler joins us as this work gets underway. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Tyler.
Hey, thank you for having me, Tom.
And let's just start with the big picture. What's on your agenda? What are you setting out to accomplish?
Well, it is a very big agenda. We're kind of looking to provide assistance to communities across Commonwealth who are impacted by various kind of environmental concerns, environmental hazards, and really kind of want to center community decision making and the health of community members within that.
And can you give us some examples, some communities that are facing those issues right now?
Oh, man. Yeah, and there are so many. I mean, yeah. I feel like there's, of course, you know, the post-flood recovery in southeast Kentucky, which is still ongoing, and a lot of the periphery issues around that, you know, water issues, whether that's contamination or access, reclamation and reuse of and redevelopment of abandoned mine lands. So there's that down in southeast Kentucky. You know, in West Louisville, you've for years, of course, similarly had issues in Rubber Town around air quality, around soil quality, similar issues, you know, in northern Kentucky, lots of issues around the entire state, you know, with contaminants in soil from agriculture. And of course, these are difficult topics, right? Because a lot of these things sort of surround industry and economy. So it's a difficult thing to navigate at times, I think.
Yeah, I would think so. So let's say that you're going into a community that's having a problem with a brownfield, which is would be, I guess, defined as a plot of land that's affected by leakage, oil leakage, or some sort of chemical leakage. And they want to clean that up and they want to move on. How do you help them do that?
Well, so at SEDIC, we actually have a lot of different arms to what we do. And we actually have a brownfield specific one of those. So I provide support to our brownfields program. So first, I would connect them with Shane Barton. Shout out to my colleague. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so what we kind of do in the brownfields program is work in tandem with the state to provide support and sort of help them work through the different phases of assessment and applications for funding and sort of community planning and assessment that can go along with that, that might help them not only inventory potential sites or really flesh out a plan for a potential site, but then the concrete steps of how to move forward in the application and redevelopment of those sites.
Well, I know, Tyler, that you're also interested in historic preservation and the design of the built environment. Older buildings and structures are often very interesting to see, to be in, to experience, but they are also often very inefficient in a lot of ways. What can be learned from those structures, and do you think it's possible to preserve their aesthetic attractiveness on the one hand, while we also pay attention to those inefficiencies that address costs and impacts on the environment? Do you think, can we have it both ways?
I think we can have it both ways. I think that's a really hard-loaded proposition, you know, at times. Uh-huh. And as it, of course, always comes down to the money piece, you know, and how do smaller communities get access to resources, to capital to do this kind of stuff. For me, you know, I find that a lot of buildings, you know, that they are sort of how communities build identity. They're how communities tell the stories of themselves. And in my mind, they're worth preserving in that way and then sort of continuing on with new stories. And I think our brownfields program is a good example of that, you know, in the ways that we can sort of work with community to tell the story of their place and hopefully set out a plan to redesign that. And, you know, some of the other SEDIC programming in the past, our downtown assessments, our current community design program, I think a lot of that dovetails with that idea and that approach to the built environment. And I think there are examples of that all across Kentucky. The one that immediately comes to mind is the Virginia Theater in Somerset and the city initiative to, you know, to preserve and restore that building and turn it into a vibrant community space that sort of pushes Somerset into the future.
Yeah, it looks great, actually. I know also that you serve on the steering committee of Kentucky Rural Urban Exchange, and I wondered if you could kind of bring us up to speed on what the organization's up to these days.
Yeah, absolutely. We're actually in our 10th year right now, so we are rocking along. We're working on a lot of really interesting big stuff. We have multiple grant programs that are available. One of them just closed for artists sort of talking and exploring place and rural urban connectedness.
We know that we live in a society today where that rural urban divide is quite broad. Is RUX making headway in bridging that gap? And where are you seeing success?
I think we are, yeah. I think if you look to our previous micro grants, that's a pretty easy, tangible way to look at this stuff and the programming that's come out of that. You could look at all of the RUX members and the RUX network and sort of the jobs that they do, you know, certainly me in this position at SEDIC, and the connections that I have in RUX that I've been able to pull from with this work, you know, and to reach out to folks like Crystal Fox in Mayfield, working in the Mayfield Minority Enrichment Center, you know, other folks around the state within the Extension Network, and more broadly, I was in Estill County yesterday, actually, meeting with their Economic Development Alliance, which was facilitated by a RUXer. So we're talking about some environmental planning for them. And yeah, and I think also just like what I've taken away from RUX that I can implement into my own work, you know, that sort of piece of that our commonalities are stronger and unite us across difference a lot more, you know, and that while I enter into this environmental justice work kind of like sort of adjacently from the EPA, and there's a lot of distrust around the EPA in Kentucky, that hopefully having those understandings and those linkages can kind of like be a bridge to repair a lot of those relationships on multiple levels. So,
all right, that's Tyler McDaniel. He is Environmental Justice Program Coordinator with the Community and Economic Development Initiative of Kentucky, also known as CEDIC. Thanks so much, Tyler.
Thank you, Tom.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Appalachia Regional Food Business Center, which includes Kentucky in its seven-state service area, have launched the first cycle of Business Builder Subawards for small and mid-sized farm and food businesses. It's part of a larger effort to strengthen the regional food economy. Adam Hudson is Senior Director of Agriculture at Cofield Development, a nonprofit based in Huntington, West Virginia. And he's with us here on Eastern Standard. Thanks for joining us, Adam.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Tell us about the intention that drives this effort to build up a food economy in the region. What is envisioned?
Yeah, so I think the center involves 18 partners across seven states, as you mentioned, the whole state of Kentucky, Ohio, West Virginia, Western Pennsylvania, Western Maryland, and Tennessee, and then Western Virginia. So it's a large geography that we're trying to work with, primarily in Appalachia, to rebuild this food economy. And a lot of these partners have been working together for many, many years just to try and make some headway in the region and in the work that we're doing in these small communities. We see it as an economic diversification as well as a way to impact the health in these communities. And from the economic side, our work began about 10 years ago, kind of siloed, not as connected with these other groups, right here in the corner of West Virginia that borders Kentucky and Ohio, and really as a workforce development initiative. But we realized quickly in order to build up an agricultural workforce, we also need to make sure there's market outlets. And with market outlets comes, there needs to be a better cold chain. We got to have cold storage. You got to have trucks, all of that work that comes into it. Our food system is complex, but we saw a lot of the good work that has happened during COVID happen. I mean, COVID was horrible and we saw a lot of the negative impacts of that, but we saw a lot of the groundwork that we had laid in place with partners across this region to have a resilient food system and give a semblance of an idea of what it could do. And thankfully, an opportunity like this comes along to where we can actually put a good bit of funding behind capacity building to build up the organization's capacity to then serve communities more efficiently, provide technical assistance to small food businesses to help them navigate all the federal processes and red tape that often comes with that, and then to provide funding opportunity through the Business Builder Subaward grants, which is kind of the full mix of what you need to really get a business to increase, you know, from 100,000 to 500,000 maybe in sales over a period of time.
What does a regional food economy look like in terms of what you envision and your intent here? What would this region that you just described produce?
I mean, for us, we spent a lot of time with these center partners. And, you know, a couple of those in Kentucky, I just want to highlight really quick, too, with the KCARD, the Kentucky Center for Agriculture and Rural Development, a Community Farm Alliance, CFA, and then Black Soil based out of Lexington, and then Mountain Association, just as an example of partners that I know a lot of listeners here might have a close reference or be able to connect with. And for us and all these partners, a regional food system looks different, you know, if you're in northern West Virginia versus you're on the Kentucky-Tennessee line. That's the way food works. It looks different, right? For us, we want to make sure we've got some resiliency. And we're supporting the local food businesses. We're increasing the farmers' resilience, whether it be from natural disasters, as we've seen here in West Virginia, we've seen a significant drought this year. So how do we build in that resilience to recover from the impacts of weather-related events, climate-related events, and then just enhancing food equity, too, within the region, a more equitable food system so consumers at any level are able to access healthy, fresh, local, you know, within couple hundred miles. We know in some cases it might not be possible to feed the entire community from the local farmers that are in the community or the local food producers that are in the community. But if we can pull it from, you know, say it's in Huntington and we've got some producers that are, you know, down around maybe Moorhead, Kentucky. And then if we can't fill it with that number of producers working with, let's go farther to maybe Mount Sterling, you know, as we continue to build that out so we can increase the opportunity and the availability of fresh, healthy local food.
That's really interesting. Now, we're talking just a couple of days before the first round of this $16 million grant program closed, the first round. And there'll be five more rounds of funding, I think, available up through 2027. Am I right about that?
Yep, that's correct. Yeah, there'll be five rounds, each round about $3 million in funding available.
Okay. Can you tell us what kinds of businesses are eligible and maybe what sorts of enterprises have already shown interest?
This is a brand new program from USDA, and we've been, and it's technically the partners through the lead partner, Rural Action, based in Ohio, is technically in we're in a cooperative agreement with USDA, which is a little more hands-on than a typical grant program, which means we've had a lot of back and forth with USDA to get this right, and there's still some unknowns out there as well. But what I can say is, and we've had a lot of applicants, I think we're over 200 applicants as of right now. Not all of those have been completed and gone through. Some of those are still in the draft phase in the portal. We're expecting to see a lot of those over the last few minutes come, you know, minutes, days come through. And the program is designed for capacity building. It's open to the terminology we're using is food business and kind of looking more at that value added or value chain development. It will not fund direct production. So a farmer that wants to buy a new lettuce harvester for the field, that probably is not going to be eligible. However, I would never discourage any producer, if they even think they might have an idea for something that they want to get support with, to reach out to one of the center partners first. Don't just read the label on the website and think, oh, I don't qualify, because we're here to help make sure that if we can't, we're going to try and connect you with another state agency or another nonprofit that maybe has funding or some kind of TA to help meet the need. Like forklifts are available. You know, that's, so that's something that if you're running a small food hub or a small warehouse location for your wash and pack shed or something, you might need it to load up your truck and distribute your products. That's an eligible expense for the funding. Staff time is an eligible expense for the funding. Maybe you're starting up a new CSA program and you want to distribute that weekly to X number of individuals in the community. But what you need to probably cover is somebody's time to do some coordination with other local farmers and maybe the current farm to curate those food boxes and, you know, CSA boxes that go out. So just cover that while you kind of pilot how to expand that and then bring it to profitability and sustainability. We've had some that are like jam and jelly makers, you know, at a larger scale, they're trying to scale up. We've had applicants from that. We've had a couple of other nonprofit organizations that are doing some like really deep rooted community value chain work, which is in like the, in Huntington, I know of a nonprofit that applied and they're doing a lot of work in a food desert area. So they're trying to see how do they increase the production within that community through outreach and training. This is another example.
As I understand it, these are reimbursable grants. And I take it that means that the business first puts up the money and then is paid back by the grant. Is that how it works?
Yeah, that's how it works. There are rare instances, I think, where we can get approval for an advance. But just through our work with USDA, that has not been advised in most cases. Mm-hmm. It's preferred to be reimbursable based on the standards we've set with USDA's approval of our plan. We do have a couple of financial organizations involved with the center that are working on bridge loans, so short, low interest loan programs to help with that cash flow, because we understand that cash flow is going to be a challenge for some businesses since it's reimbursable.
Well, I think you touched on this a moment ago, but can businesses that want to apply, but they don't know where to begin, or they, you know, they're so busy, they just don't have time to deal with the paperwork, they can get help from your organization?
Our organization, I would say the center partners for the Appalachia Regional Food Business Center at large, we want to direct people to the partners that are closest to them or who has an expertise in the field. So for us, if we have somebody who comes in who's maybe in central Kentucky who would reach out to us, I would probably direct them first back to one of those Kentucky organizations if they have the capacity. If they're like at capacity and they need, and this is something that's within our expertise, a type of operation that we have some good in-house knowledge about, then we could step in and support that to alleviate that strain. So that's a benefit of this large network of partners. We're not writing the grant proposals for them. We do have several entities that they could go through to get that level of assistance that we've got connections with out there.
I think the really good message here is don't be discouraged. There is help.
Right. Exactly. There's no closed door. We're going to work with folks to get them the resources they need and that they're seeking to help improve their businesses.
Well, Adam, how can a small or a mid-sized food or farm business apply for one of the future rounds of grant awards?
I would advise anyone to go to the Appalachia Regional Food Business Center website. If you've got connections with one of those partners, if you recognize the name of one of the partners that's listed there, try reaching out to them directly. You can also email the center directly through, there's a contact on there. And then that can be directed to somebody. They usually direct it back to someone within the region that the contact is reaching out from. And somebody will reach out and usually just kind of talk through your needs in your business and kind of what you're looking to do. And you can also, like I said, there's an apply button on there, and it'll take you right to the application and you can download it, look through it. Pretty sure you can even do a whole preview if you want before you apply. So then you know exactly what questions are on there to answer. We tried to make it as simple as we could, but we had to follow federal guidelines and federal regulations that kind of binded us to certain things that we had to do because this is federal money. So we had to take the responsibility there of crossing all of our T's and dotting all of our I's.
That's Adam Hudson. He's Senior Director of Agriculture at Coalfield Development in Huntington, West Virginia. Thanks, Adam.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Coming up after the break, Art Shackett, host of our Undermain Art Series with Heather Lyons, Arts and Culture Director for the City of Lexington, on plans for celebrating the city's 250th anniversary next year. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Leanne Potter with the Kentucky Arts Council. Coming up in Central and Eastern Kentucky Arts, a traveling exhibit called Native Reflections, Visual Art by American Indians Living in Kentucky, is on display through November 15th in the Capitol Rotunda in Frankfort and will open in Somerset December 4th at the Center for Rural Development. The Lead Center for the Arts is presenting Disney's The Little Mermaid Jr. November 15th through the 17th. Tickets are available on the center's website, leadcenter.org. The award ceremony for the recipients of the Governor's Awards in the Arts will be held Thursday, November 21st at 2:30 in the Capitol Rotunda. The awards annually recognize individuals and organizations that have made extraordinary and significant contributions to the arts in Kentucky. The event is open to the public and will be live streamed on our Facebook page. From the Kentucky Arts Council, for Eastern Standard, I'm Leanne Potter.
Lexington's getting ready for a big year. 2025 will be the city's semi-quincentennial, the 250th anniversary of its founding way back in 1775. That was a year before the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And much of our city's varied history, amazing, colorful, and disturbing, will be expressed through art. Let's hear more about it in part two of Art Shackett's conversation with Lexington Arts and Culture Director Heather Lyons.
What is the plan for that celebration?
First off, the mayor created a 250 Lex Commission. And so there are, I believe, 25 individuals from the community involved in establishing what we wanted to do and to celebrate. I'm on that commission and am a co-chair of the programming committee. And so as part of that, we really wanted to ensure that local organizations had an opportunity and support to create new work or to enhance the work that they may already be doing, to expand it for that anniversary year. And so we established a grant program for organizations or artists, not just arts, but also arts, cultural, historical organizations to apply to that. Even prior to that, the mayor had already established that she wanted significant art to be created and presented in that anniversary year. And so there are two initiatives that I'm involved in working on. One is a public art work that will be installed on Main Street. And then the other is commissioning an orchestral work for the Lexington Philharmonic with Sean Opeblo, a Lexington native and a now internationally acclaimed composer. And so he'll be creating a work that we'll present in a free concert to the city in September of 2025.
Can we expect to see events and different kinds of programming throughout the year of 2025?
Absolutely. They're going to be announcing in October somewhat of the calendar for the year. Just within the grants themselves that we awarded, there were 18 organizations and artists who are going to be creating and presenting new work. But every single month is going to have many, many different events and activities and initiatives that are taking place as part of that celebration. Another focus area that I'm involved in is a community group that is focusing on Lexington's literary legacy. And, you know, a lot of people may not be aware, but the first newspaper west of the Alleghenies was published here in Lexington. One of the first printing presses was here in Lexington. Of the past 9 Kentucky Poet Laureates, 7 of them are from or have been in Lexington for a very long time. So it reaches into journalism, into fiction, into poetry. But the full month of April, which is National Poetry Month, we're going to be devoting to celebrating Lexington's writers, poets, authors. And so that's going to have many events and elements within it.
Will all these events and programming events and materials be free to the public?
A great number of them will. That was really one of the main interests, was that as much of this programming as possible would be free or very low cost. And even events that typically that may be taking place at, you know, venues that are expensive and that would require higher ticket prices, a lot of the funding is going toward them being able to subsidize those tickets, to reduce the ticket prices, to provide pay-what-you-can performances, so and as many of them as can be free as possible.
You mentioned about a major public art piece that will be installed on Main Street. Please tell us more about that.
Okay. That was an interest of the mayor's initially, and she set aside specific funding to support that in 2023. So she was really looking ahead 2 years to be able to create something. So we first put together a steering committee of Lexington artists and design professionals, architects, to decide what is this going to be? What do we even want to ask artists to respond to? And so a survey was done, a lot of reaching out to the community, but that steering committee determined to create first an RFQ, just a request for qualifications, where we would be asking artists to respond. They determined to set it up as a national call. And we put that call onto CAFE, which is a call for entries. It's one of the major ways, but also posted it on a number of other calls like Coda Works and that sort of thing, and then promoted it a lot within the state with emails and other artists' services. And then we established a separate selection committee. And so we received about 177 applications, and then that selection committee reviewed all of them and came up with 3 finalists. Those 3 finalists were then asked to create site-specific proposals. And then those artists came into Lexington, presented those proposals in person. And then one artist, Benjamin Ball of Ball Nogi's studio, was selected.
Can people access images of this sculpture that will be installed on Main Street?
Not yet. When all of the artists submitted their proposals, you know, their working concepts. And so right now it's in a continuing design and development phase. We'll be releasing designs, you know, when we have a finished, approved design. You know, with every public art project, they're also unique because of the determination of the site, you know, what you're hoping to achieve with that work, what has to be done to prepare for that work. So there's a lot of moving parts, you know, where you have to go through a geotech survey that the artist is coordinating to find out what lies below the surface, because they can't determine how they're going to install something unless they know, is it rubble? Is it solid dirt? Is it solid rock or whatever? So a lot of technical concerns that have to be dealt with. But then absolutely, when we have a finished design, I'm very excited to be able to present that to the community.
And that is often perilous territory, because everybody has an opinion about public arts.
Of course.
And one of the things that you do is you sit on the Public Arts Commission. And why don't you tell us about the Public Arts Commission and what its mission is, mm-hmm. and how it goes about its business?
Okay. The Public Art Commission has been a really interesting and, as I mentioned, evolving entity for the city. In 2002, it was first created. However, there was no funding for that Public Art Commission to utilize. So it took all the way up until 2018 for the council to then approve a resolution, the Percent for Art resolution, that then gave a Public Art Commission some funding to utilize. So since that time, as I mentioned, we created a Public Art Master Plan. That was a result of, we looked at many, many master plans from across the country, really sort of picking and choosing, taking what we felt was the best. And that is available online for people to look at. I think it's a very readable document, but it really established a mission and a vision and goals. A lot of those goals include, you know, working with the local community to encourage them to submit applications and ideas. We don't want to just be the governing entity that makes all of the decisions and also is the only commissioning entity, you know. So I've been very excited that now we're starting to see community applications coming to us and those own initiatives, and that's what I want to see more of. But the Public Art Commission is a reviewing process for any public art that's going to be installed on city-owned property. So we only review city-owned. Some of the goals that were established by the commission were to first try to support funding art in districts in Lexington where there isn't currently much or even any public art. And so we identified those districts. We have a public art map on our website, which can be viewed with images and information about the artists and the work. And so it's very easy to see. And of course, downtown area is one of the most significant areas where you will find public art. But we've been trying to initiate projects that will take place in other areas. And so the Public Art Commission commissions work and then also approves other community projects.
So how does the Public Art Commission get its money to pay for commissioned work?
The Percent for Art Fund is a percent of capital funds that come into the city. So any capital projects, buildings that are built, renovations of buildings, even streets and roads repair, and purchases of large vehicles like fire trucks, those are all considered capital expenses. And so 1% of those funds that are appropriated in the budget each year is then set aside for public art. One of the distinctions within that resolution is that any capital project of $10 million or more requires that that 1% be spent at that exact property. So, for instance, the Lexington Detention Center had a $10 million roof. It's a huge facility. So because of that $10 million project, we're doing a public art project on the grounds of the detention center. And that was the first work commissioned by the Public Art Commission, and it will be the first one to be completed.
This could be a very significant amount of money annually that goes to commission public work.
Yes. I mean, right now we're looking at about, you know, again, it will vary from year to year, but about $300,000 a year, give or take, that we're able to dedicate to public art. And just to give you an idea of some of the projects, I mean, it's only been about a year and a half now that we've been able to start doing that. But for instance, we contributed to the John Henry sculpture, relocating it from the grounds of Ashland to now, I think, an absolutely stunning location in front of Central Bank
Center. It's really great there.
It's a perfect location. We were able to purchase LaVon Williams, local treasure, I think, incredible local artist. He created, actually, there's six carved wooden panels, 3 feet by 6 feet, that tell the story of Isaac Murphy. And I'm actually working right now with just left LaVon because we're going to be creating a way to install those in the lobby of the government center. Those are really stunning. We're working on the Lexington Detention Project, which a Louisville artist, Dave Cottle, was selected to do that sculptural project. We also have a Gainesway Park project in the, we have not selected an artist, but we have dedicated funds to do that. And then we've also approved funding to support the Lexington Freedom Train project that will be installed on 4th and Limestone. We funded a Metathorpe mural that the neighborhood association there wanted to put on their community center to celebrate their upcoming 75th anniversary of that neighborhood. We just supported Lexington Senior Center, a local artist, Donna Mint, who created 12 stunning, very large format photographs that represent each season of the year that are being installed in the community center. And then we're doing utility boxes. And so we have six ready to be installed, six new local artists whose work, and then another six in line for some that I hope to get installed in April.
People are really going to be able to see the impact, big and small, that these installations and works have on our everyday life and the quality of life here in Lexington. Thank you for
Absolutely.
All you do for the arts and culture scene here in Lexington and all the hard work with your busy portfolio.
Well.
and thanks for taking the time out of your busy schedule to join us here on Eastern Standard. Thanks again.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out our archive, our series, our partners, and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. And you can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, Buzzsprout, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. And remember, as Yogi Berra put it, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.